become prosperous, and why are many nations poor? Many nations have all sorts of natural resources, and yet those countries are extremely poor, and the people there can't get ahead. In those nations where they have allowed the right to own private property, where they have allowed the entrepreneurship, where they have allowed economic freedom, many times, of course, you see the lot of the common man increasing and improving. And, of course, the case in point would be communist China. And even though it is a dictatorship, there's this element of economic freedom there, and certainly the lot of the average individual has improved considerably. And the same thing is certainly happening in India. There's tremendous government control over many things, but if you are in an industry that's trading with other countries, certainly why you can go ahead and establish the business, and you can do quite well. And as a result of the fact that there has been some relaxing of government controls over the lives of the Indian people, with a lot of the Indian people, the lives of the Indian people are improving. Mr. Powell, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed your book very much. The title is, of course, Making Poor Nations Rich, Entrepreneurship and the Process of Economic Development. And, of course, our guest, you know, certainly is deeply involved with economics. He has an endorsement of his books by Ernest Zedillo, who is the former president of Mexico and now, of course, working at Yale Center for Globalization. And, of course, all these ideas are really great. And certainly there's a great deal of truth in what you say and how so impoverished so much of the world is today. And yet here in the West, why, of course, tragically, here in the United States, we see ever more government regulation really in many respects strangling the free enterprise system. And although we certainly have today the most prosperous nation in the world, how long will it exist as long as we keep increasing government controls over every aspect of our lives?
Yeah, well, this is true, and I think the foundation lesson of the book is that it's respect for private property rights, economic freedom, and the rule of law that generates economic prosperity and development. And, you know, we've seen other places that have choked off. Maybe this is fitting on a, you know, Super Tuesday here, as the United States seems to be marching towards more restrictions on these type of activities, and, you know, each candidate has their own proposals for some form of semi-socialized medicine or what have you. Sweden, you know, is one country we study in the book. And Sweden's usually held up as a kind of a success story for supposedly having this social safety net and socialized medicine and other things. And they say, hey, well, look, Sweden's fairly wealthy, but it can afford these things. Why can't we do it here? And what we find with Sweden is actually, you know, they did most of their growing before they implemented this. In 1970, Sweden was the fourth richest country in the world. Now they're below the median in the OECD. They've fallen to the bottom half of OECD countries. So, you know, it hasn't impoverished them and made them poor, but it's kind of choked off their growth engine. Whereas back before, in the 1950s and 60s, Sweden had tax rates that were lower than in Britain or in the United States. But since they've kind of implemented their welfare state, their growth really dropped off.
Right, and of course, as taxes, you know, up around the 50%. A bracket, you know, everything's regulated from the cradle to the grave, and we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. Benjamin Powell, and talking about certainly the background of freedom and how important freedom is for prosperity.
Now you can enjoy the most delicious, freshest, and healthiest drinking water anytime, even while traveling, during outdoor sporting activities, and in hospital filtration environments such as local or national emergencies. The revolutionary Berkey Light removes pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful or unwanted chemicals to below detectable levels. It also removes foul tastes and odors like that rotten egg smell of sulfide, and it reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury while leaving in the healthful and nutritional minerals your body body needs. The Berkey Light is so powerful it can purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds. The Berkey Light is transparent and glows in the dark with its rechargeable LED lighting system, so it can be used as a night light or camp light.
Get the Berkey Light Purifier for only $279. Call New Millennium, 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Or order on the web at berkeywater.com. Not yet available in Iowa.
Do you need more than just the constant news of impending tyranny? Yes, this is Elizabeth Border back with the Divided Kingdom, the hour that analyzes spiritual and cultural issues too. Lou Blanchard and I are delighted, thanks in large part to past listeners' lobbying efforts. Now to be on the Great Genesis Communications Network Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Central, formidable Alex Jones says, this is the network often imitated but never duplicated. Lou and I made the conscious decision to move to GCN because of its classy lineup and leadership. We invite you to hear our program, one we pray will strengthen and bless you. Indeed, trouble is part of the story, but the fellowship of faith surpasses it. Tune in at 6 p.m. Central with the Divided Kingdom.
Hi, this is Brother Michael Diamond. You can now get the most important package ever on what has happened to the Catholic Church in the last 50 years. Find out how this massive crisis concerning the Catholic Church happened, what happened, and how the Bible predicted it would take place in the last days. The package contains 6 DVDs that contain 10 different programs, 2 books that combined are over 1,000 pages and other information. Order now at our website, mostholyfamilymonastery.com. That's mostholyfamilymonastery.com. The last word monastery is spelled M-O-N-A-S-T-E-R-Y. Or call us at 1-800-275-1126. That's 1-800-275-1126. Or mail in your order to us at 4425 Schneider Road, Fillmore, New York, 14735. The total cost for this massive package of information is only $10, $15 for UPS Ground, or $30 outside the U.S.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network. Our guest is Benjamin Powell. His book, Begging for Nations Rich, and I thought this was really fascinating. I know I've always wondered, well, you know, certainly if it works, socialism works all right in Sweden. They have this wonderful, they have this safety net, and they've got public health. They've got, you know, socialized medicine. They've got all sorts of, you know, pension benefits. And, well, of course, at the taxes are high, about 50% or more for the average individual, but you know, a lot of people seem to be very, very happy with living there. But then, of course, Mr. Powell points out is that they had a very prosperous economy up until 1975, when they adopted all these crazy socialist programs. And since then, why, of course, their economy has been able to maintain, you know, and provide the funding, but their overall rating has gone down from being the fourth largest economy in the world to being on the low side of the OECD nations. In other words, their economy is gradually collapsing. And one of these days, especially if we get into real economic problems in the world, why, their economy may collapse. And then when they try to build it back up again with all these regulations in place, they would never be able to establish the prosperity they have today. Has that thought crossed your mind?
Yeah, I think this is important, but we also should be careful to not overdo Sweden's march towards socialism. While they have the big social safety net and the high taxing and spending, you know, a lot of the other areas of economic freedom are still there, so they haven't kind of totally deviated from the path of prosperity. There's still good protection of property rights. They're still on the low side in terms of regulatory activity, actually, in terms of how business are regulated. And, you know, freedom to trade internationally and international investment is still really good there. Monetary stability is good. So, you know, a lot of the parts of economic freedom are there. It's just really the size of government and transfers that's a real drag on Sweden. And, it certainly has been a drag. I mean, like when you look at the engine of creativity in the economy, the entrepreneurial process, and this is where a lot of the new jobs come from. You know, out of the 34 most developed countries, Sweden's the sixth lowest, actually, in terms of entrepreneurial activity. So, you know, the burden's there and it's slowed, but it's not, a lot of the pieces are still there for them. It's not like they've suddenly descended into being, you know, basket case like some of the African countries.
Absolutely not. But certainly, you know, for a young person trying to buy a home, I mean, trying to buy an apartment, or you're getting married, I mean, my understanding is that it's pretty tough on the younger people. The older people have their homes, they have their property, but for the young person coming down the line, it's really quite difficult.
Yeah, I think this is also an important point. I mean, when you look around the world, for any listeners, you know, who have traveled other places, income statistics can be a little bit misleading, too, because how well off a country is isn't just your level of current income, but also kind of your accumulated wealth. And, you know, a place like Sweden that's been around for a long time and was wealthy before has a big capital stock of nice homes and existing things that were there before they started slowing down in their economic activity. So it's certainly easier for people who prospered before.
And of course, you really stress over and over again in all of the various chapters of the book the importance of the right of private property, of encouraging people to be entrepreneurs, and then, of course, to have the economic freedom. And of course, you point out that the regulation of business and industry and commerce, I mean, this creates all sorts of problems as far as really successful businesses. And without successful businesses, you can't have prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, for this entrepreneurial activity, for those of you who have traveled around, you see it no matter where you go. There's always people who want to be entrepreneurs. It's a question of how well society creates these institutions that kind of channel the entrepreneurial activity to those things that make everybody else in society better off. You see kind of the desperate form of entrepreneurship when there's simply no other jobs in the economy in some of the very poor places of the world. You get off your airplane or your bus and there's a million people trying to sell you trinkets or what have you. I mean, that's entrepreneurship. They're trying to get ahead,
sure.
But they have such bad property rights and regulation that they can't do it in a socially, I mean, I guess it is socially productive and they're creating some services for people, but they're really limited in how much they can do this. But also, and then even the worst type of entrepreneurship, which is the unproductive or the destructive stuff, and that's when the way entrepreneurs get ahead is not by serving their fellow consumer, but by, you know, getting privileges bestowed on them by their government that either get them transfers of money from the government or put barriers up to the other people who would otherwise compete with them to serve consumers. That type of entrepreneurship is what really drags an economy down.
And I thought your point was so well made. You know, the one time the way to get ahead in China was to study hard, go to college, study hard, and get to be a bureaucrat.
Yeah, when the rewards are to go and become a bureaucrat, you can be pretty sure that your economy is not going to be a great grower. But, you know, that's completely transformed today. Now in China, people aspire to be, you know, electrical engineers or international finance people and businessmen and import-exporters. It's been quite a transformation in China, really.
And even though it's an authoritarian structure at the top, they've actually encouraged the private industry, and they've encouraged entrepreneurship, which is almost contradictory, but you see this economic miracle unfolding in China today.
Yeah, I think this is an important point you make. There's a difference between political freedom and economic freedom. And China, while they've remained, you know, in name communist, kind of the opposite of Russia, actually. In Russia, while they've given up communism formally, the more things change, the more they stay the same. In China, what's happened is, while they've retained their political authoritarian regime, they've granted a lot more economic freedom. So there's a difference between the right to vote, the freedom of speech type issues, and those that are respect for the property rights, freedom to contract, and freedom to trade. And China's been good at giving one of them. In fact, actually, while they still maintain their, you know, supposedly communist system, they've actually been the biggest improver in economic freedom in all of Asia since 1980. Complete transformation, where before it was, you know, more than two-thirds of all of their industrial output was produced by state firms. Today it's down below one-third. It's kind of reversed itself completely over the 20-year period.
Well, one of the points you make, of course, is that the great basket case of the world is Africa. And
yeah.
There, of course, you look around for signs of economic success. And, well, you mentioned Botswana, where I've spent been there a couple of times, and certainly it's been an amazing country that's done very, very well. Only they seem, of course, to be progressively moving away from individual freedom towards the all-powerful state in the name of helping the people. But sometimes all these government programs supposedly going to help the people already do nothing but crush free enterprise.
Yeah, the Botswana. Before we get too down on it, first we should be very happy at the success it's had. You know, from mid-1960s to the mid-1990s, it was the fastest-growing country in the world, near 8% clip in real terms per capita. But, you know, of course, that's starting from a very low base, too. But you're completely correct that more recently they have been moving towards bigger government, and the way it's been happening, it's really kind of the curse of see Botswana when it first got its independence. It was a semi-arid British protectorate that was landlocked and was largely ignored, and there wasn't really very much for the people to fight over. So they kind of adopted British institutions of rule of law, protection of property rights, economic freedom, and that's how they got this great growth growing. But since then, they've later discovered that they actually have diamonds there, and as the diamond industry has grown, the government seems to be pulling more and more revenue from the diamond industry so that it can grow more bloated. And the real risk there is, if the diamond revenues tap off and now they've got their big bloated government, how are they going to finance it given the rest of their domestic base? So that doesn't bode well for them in the future, but at least in the past they've been pretty successful.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the people there really, because they all come from the same tribe, which of course helps them, and of course their president was their tribal chief, and then building upon the traditions that had been left over from the British colonialism. It was really an amazing country when I was there.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point that you raised, too. There's a difference in a place like Botswana, where it's mostly one tribal group that's there that built off of, like, while they adopted Western institutions of property right, contract, economic freedoms, they built off of kind of their indigenous base. Whereas a lot of the African countries are simply creations of lines politicians draw on the maps. And then you have different heterogeneous groups that don't want the same type of governance structure. And meanwhile, they end up importing some foreign governance structure on top of it and finding out that the kind of, I don't want to sound Marxist here, but the base doesn't support the superstructure.
Right.
Kind of the base beliefs of society don't support the systems governing them, and you get these clashes like you see in places like Kenya today.
And of course, one of the countries you spend a fair amount of time on is India. And, you know, of course, the average American doesn't understand India, doesn't understand their traditions, doesn't understand their religion, doesn't understand their caste system and how this influences everything, and then, of course, doesn't understand what's happening, other than we know that their economy seems to be doing fairly well. So often, you know, you'll want to get information on your Hewlett-Packard printer, why you call, and you get a fellow named Raj, and he's over in New Delhi, and he does a good job telling you exactly what needs to be done, and he has the repairman come out to your home. It's really an amazing phenomenon what's happened in India, and yet, unfortunately, well, I'm going to let you tell. People don't want to hear what I have to say. I thought it was fascinating what you and your authors had to say about India.
Yeah, hopefully, maybe they want to hear it from me, maybe not, but... India, yeah, I think the important thing you raise about Raj and the call center is India's growth has not been uniform, and neither is its economic freedom. First, it was a place there still wasn't a big ideological transformation that I know of. What really happened is they responded to a fiscal crisis they had. Kind of perversely, they were afraid, and the IMF promoted development by a country being so afraid of an IMF intervention that they made their own reforms. So India started reforming its economy in response to its fiscal crisis. But the areas that were freed up and deregulated, telecommunications, airlines was one, tariffs were lowered, foreign direct investment and capital flows were more liberalized. And the two main drivers of the growth there in India were in the telecommunications sector, back office processing type stuff, and also... of course, software development. Software, which is something that had evolved kind of after the old licensing regime that had been in place before. So what you find is these industries not subject to the licensing and the old regulations, that's where all of India's growth has been. The more traditional industries have still been really constricted and haven't been able to grow as well.
Right.
And that's what we interact with when we're trading with India now, and you get the call.
Hold that right there, please.
As the old saying goes, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. But if you give him a Berkey system, you give him the ability to obtain purified water for a lifetime. This year, when giving Christmas gifts, instead of unwanted trinkets, give a meaningful and substantial gift. Berkey systems are ideal for every member of your family, especially the young ones in college. Unlike other water filtration systems, Berkey purifiers are portable. They require no plumbing, and the elements don't have to be replaced every 4 to 6 months. Perfect for anyone on a tight budget. And more importantly, if there's an unexpected emergency, your loved ones will be prepared. That's because Berkey systems are able to purify raw, untreated water. Check out our Christmas specials at BerkeyWater.com. With one of our quantity specials, you not only get a discount, but in one stop, you can get gifts for the entire family. That's BerkeyWater.com or call 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Gold is like nothing else on Earth. From the Romans through the Renaissance, from the Industrial Age to the Space Age, gold has weathered the test of time. For 6,000 years, gold has remained the ultimate store of wealth. According to the World Gold Council and the U.S. Mint, demand is at an all-time high. The stage is being set for the reemergence of gold as the common sense alternative to a fiat paper currency that gets weaker every day. Midas Resources is proud to offer the hard-hitting report that arms you with the truth you need to protect you and your family from the Fed's plans for your hard-earned money. Don't gamble with your future. Call Midas Resources today and ask for your free copy of As Good as Gold. Call 1-800-686-2233 for the report the Fed hopes you'll never see. As Good as Gold can be yours by calling 800-686-2237. If you have ever thought about owning gold, you must read this report. Call Midas today at 800-686-2237.
This is George Winkers Berry of the Genesis Communications Network. Have you ever wanted the truth about the economy? Crash, Are You Ready? Is the fastest growing program on GCN. Our one-hour program airs weekdays Monday through Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. Central Time, just after the Power Hour and just before Alex Jones. To listen to rebroadcast 24 and 7, visit our website at www.hearitonline.com and click on the appropriate link. Our unparalleled guest lineup has included patriots such as Congressman Ron Paul, Scott Ritter, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Murray Neal, inventor of the revolutionary dragonskin body armor, and Philip Torme, USS Liberty survivor. We also focus on alternative health and survival topics. Go to www.hearitonline.com. That's HEARITONLINE.com.
Since the year 2000, earthquakes, heat waves, droughts, tsunamis, floods, fires, and hurricanes have killed over 1 million people worldwide and forced tens of millions to go without food and water. After Katrina, the media was eager to show victims in New Orleans begging for food. If a disaster strikes you and your loved ones and you have no stored food, you'll be begging as well. Now our economy is slipping into an abyss that even Donald Trump says will make the Great Depression look like a Sunday picnic. The U.S. dollar is worth less today than it was even last week. Before food prices skyrocket, trucks stop running and stores close their doors, Survival Enterprises can help you prepare. They're master distributors of Mountain House freeze-dried food with up to a 50-year shelf life. Survival Enterprises has real butter, cheese, and bread, real beef, chicken, and turkey, all canned for long-term storage. For their website and more info, call 1-800-753-1981. That's 1-800-753-1981. And remember, if you wait until you need us, it's too late. Call now.
Stan back here at the Genesis Communication Network. Our guest, Benjamin Powell, is Bookmaking for Nations Rich. And, of course, the basic message of the book is that if you have freedom, if you have economic freedom, if you have political freedom, and you don't even need the political freedom, but certainly I don't think people work quite as well if they certainly do not have the political freedom, but the private property, rights of private property, and the economic freedom stimulates the economy. Now, looking at Africa, Africa is pretty much a basket case, and with probably only Botswana, there's certainly one of the most prosperous nations in Africa. But, you know, Mr. Powell, as having lived in Africa, I can tell you that South Africa was a good place to live. They were working out their race problems, and And they would have worked them out had not America interfered, and now they've got 50% unemployment. Sydney and Rhodesia, where, of course, they really did not have a race problem. There may have been inequalities because some people were richer than others, but certainly there was no racial discrimination, and America's interference in Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and in South Africa has created terrible, terrible problems and economic problems there, and brought in socialism. Why would we have done that? Why would we have insisted on putting a socialist like Mugabe into power, or Marxist like Mugabe into power in Zimbabwe? It is American interference, or the interference of the International Monetary Fund, or often of the World Bank, that actually makes things worse rather than better.
Yeah, I think this is an important point, that our first rule when coming to the third world should be, at first, do no harm. And I think you're exactly right. We've done a lot of harm in the past. In some sense, it's a tragedy of when African countries got their independence. We're talking the 50s and 60s for most of them. And, it's a time where the dominant intellectual trend is towards some version of socialism or industrial policy planning of some sort. And the African leaders were quick to seize upon that. There was also, I think, and maybe you have a good feel for it, did you say you lived in South Africa?
Yes, I taught there at the major university.
I think some of it, in general, would you agree that there's just kind of was a general backlash against all things a lot of countries viewed as associated with colonialism, and they mistakenly viewed capitalism as part of colonialism, which kind of, I think, gave an excuse or a tendency towards leaders to adopt those type of policies, as well as our advice.
Right. Well, I think our advice had a lot to do with it. Of course, we installed the rulers in all of those countries, and the elections were all rigged. I mean, they had 40 million voters and 80 million ballots, and you'd never guess who won, the man that the U.S. State Department wanted. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I think certainly a lot of U.S. aid in particular, but also maybe World Bank aid as well, was often more about, at least in the past, more about Cold War politics than actually promoting development. Maybe that's less of a problem today with the Cold War behind us, but I still certainly suspect that politics drives a lot of it.
Well, certainly one of my favorite economists is Joseph Stiglitz. Now, I've never talked to him or met him, but I've read all of as many of his books as were popularized. And he certainly, having worked for the World Bank, pointed out the IMF was, one of the major problems we had in the world today, bringing about poverty for the people. And then, of course, when he left the World Bank, he included them there as well.
Stiglitz's book, I agree with a lot of criticisms of the IMF that are in there, and I think maybe they've done more damage than anybody else. But the subtitle should have been, why if only I was in charge, then everything would work right. So while he has complaints with the policies that were implemented, he doesn't take the fundamental view of free markets and property rights as the solution. Instead, for him, it's just another version of planning. It just has to be Joe Stiglitz's planning.
Right. Well, we agree that the planners are the ones who give some money to the problems. And one of the points you make in your book is that so much of the foreign aid that we give goes to the bureaucrats in the various countries. And, of course, their job is just to expand their control and power. And instead of that money being used to help the people, the bureaucracy grows and grows and grows, and then, of course, they get further and further into debt, and then they have to tax the people, to get the money to pay the interest on the debt, and it's almost an impossible situation in most countries in Africa today.
Yeah, I did an article a couple of years ago. USA Today's Parade magazine published a list called The 20 Worst Dictators in the World. And a graduate student of mine looked up the official development assistance, and we found that every single one of them had got aid from OECD countries, and 19 of the 20 had got it from the U.S. government. I think part of the problem is we end up locking in kind of bad political leaders. In a sense, foreign aid, when it goes in and it's going to be distributed by governments, it, enhances the political sphere to relative to the private one, and allows these leaders to buy off more support and maintain their grip on power in these countries, and also, in a sense, give them less incentive to let the country develop because they're able to maintain their position through, directing the aid flows.
Amen to that. And then, we're going to be back in just a moment. Our guest is Benjamin Powell. His book is Making Poor Nations Rich. And I think that anybody who values freedom will enjoy reading the book because, of course, the major thing, private property and economic freedom. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Hello, folks. Alex Jones here, introducing Prudent Places USA, an interactive CD book that is your premier resource for hard-to-find information. Find out about everything from job migration to evacuation information, such as major bridges in disrepair and FEMA evacuation time studies for coastal cities. Zero in on man-made disaster zones, environmental areas of concern, and natural disaster zones. Find out everything from where to get water in an emergency to geographic income levels. Housing crisis, complete with over 3 gigabytes of detailed information on the 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., full-color photographs, 550 high-resolution full-color maps, and detailed information and analysis that you need. Order Prudent Places USA now for only $29, plus shipping, by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. And tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438, or order online at BerkeyWater.com.
Have you made preparations to look after yourself and your family in case there's a national emergency or a terrorist attack? Well, I want to tell you that the government's looking after their people. In fact, plans have been made to protect people of high-ranking position in government, but they're not making any preparations for the average individual, so you're going to have to look after yourself. If you'd like information on long-term food storage, if you'd like information on the other items you would need in case of a national emergency, why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for the emergency food catalog. We'll get it right off to you, and we'll get the items shipped directly from Ready Reserve Foods. That's 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. You're going to have to begin making preparations to look after yourself.
Where do you think one of the most toxic places on Earth is? The answer may surprise you. It's in your body. The colon is a natural breeding ground for disease-producing germs. It may not sound like a very appealing subject, but it should not go ignored. For over a decade now, natural health expert Dr. Lauren Ritter has educated people everywhere about the benefits of internal cleansing. Now, these benefits include higher energy levels, more comfortable digestion, high immune support, and healthier looking skin. Now you can try Dr. Ritter's colon cleansing program from the privacy of your own home. It's safe and natural, and it gently cleanses the entire digestive tract. Don't let your body be the most toxic place on earth. Take care of your health by cleansing your colon and body. Dial 1-800-457-9914. That's 1-800-457-9914. Call now to find out how you can get the colon and body cleanse risk-free for 30 days. Dial 1-800-457-9914. Call now.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Genesis Communication Network. And before we go on, Mr. Powell, would you like to go ahead and get out your website and tell people how to get copies of your book?
Sure. To get copies of the book, I mean, it's as simple as going to Amazon, if you like, or you could also go to the Independent Institute's website, www.independent.org, and order it from them.
Now, where is the Independent Institute?
Independent Institute?
Yeah, Independent. The institute you just mentioned.
Yes, is in Oakland, California.
I thought it was, because we're not too far from there. We got quite a bit of information from them. Well, of course, the book really goes back, you know, through the ages, goes back to ancient Rome. And, of course, Rome, you know, had one problem. They had too many government regulations. And even though there was people wanted to be entrepreneurs, and they developed things like the water wheel, why, of course, these things were not implemented because there were all the bureaucratic problems, all the bureaucratic regulations. Would you like to sort of pick up on that idea? Because I thought it was so fascinating. The bureaucracy has always been with it, hasn't it?
It goes way back. And in fact, you know, interestingly, a lot of the things that we think of as, you know, quote, great civilizations of the past, while they left us lots of fancy monuments that were built up that we can see today, it didn't really improve the average life of the person living in those societies very much. Certainly true of civilizations such as Egypt, where you have the pyramids, but also a lot of the Roman infrastructure that was left over. In fact, in Rome, you know, people bemoan the, quote, Dark Ages, where the roads all deteriorated that the Romans had put in. And, well, you know, the saying, all roads lead to Rome, is for a reason. It was set up so that it was a system of tribute where they'd go over and conquer other people, and the roads were made for marching armies back and forth and bringing the tribute back. The roads weren't set up for the type of commerce that's necessary for long-term economic development. When it came to moving wagons on them and such, they were the wrong size and grade for the type of wheels that you'd use. So it's no, you know, no accident people let them deteriorate later. It was a society that was, you know, set up for political privilege of those in Rome at the expense of the rest of the empire.
And of course, all the regulations, and that was the thing that I gleaned from the book. The regulations just oppressed the private, you know, individual, and certainly the limited economic freedom. And certainly, then of course, you talk about modern day Ireland. What a miracle that apparently is.
Yeah, Ireland is a really dramatic success story turnaround. Of course, I mean, they were never poor like areas in Latin America or Sub-Saharan Africa, but by European standards, they were fairly poor. They were about two-thirds the living standard of living of Great Britain back in 1985. And in Ireland, there was no kind of Thatcher revolution or Reagan-style revolution in Ireland. In fact, the same big-spending prime minister power in 85 was the same one who was there making the bad policies in the 1970s. But what happened there, they, much like India, faced a fiscal crisis, and they were afraid of an IMF intervention. They had previously tried getting out of it with higher taxes, but they found that couldn't compensate them with enough revenue. They had played around with inflation before, but didn't want to go back to inflating again. And, you know, governments get three ways. They put the money three ways. They print the money, they tax it from somebody, or they have to borrow it. And the problem was they had borrowed too darn much of it. Their debt ratio was about 120% the size of the economy. So they had to slash spending. It was purely pragmatic, and over the course of the first 5 years, they cut the spending back. So government shrank from over half the economy down to about 40% in a five-year period. That's a pretty big change for a small amount of time. And then by the mid-90s, you know, tax revenues as a percent of GDP were down to about a third of the size of the economy. And this pullback in government spending, with other good policies, I mean, Ireland always had decent respect for property rights and the rule of law there, but they had opened up to international trade in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, and then with this final freeing, they really took off. The last half of the 90s, they were averaging over 10% growth.
And which is really phenomenal. You know, I mean, we're talking about, I think, about 2%, 2.1% for this year for the United States.
Oh, yeah, it's phenomenal. 10% over a five-year period is just absolutely fantastic. And, in fact, Ireland, you know, a country that traditionally people moved out of, actually started experiencing net in-migration during the boom. People were actually leaving, you know, places like where I am now, Boston, and moving back to Ireland for the job opportunities there. Ireland certainly did benefit by having, you know, the European market close by and having a large, you know, educated English-speaking population right there. But those things by itself don't explain Ireland's big takeoff, because they have always kind of had those advantages. It was this last kind of freeing of their economy, the cutting of government spending and the slashing of taxes and the scale back on regulations that allowed them to really take off.
And really, it's cutting back on government. That's the biggest thing. In fact, one of the examples of that was New Zealand. What happened in New Zealand?
Yeah, New Zealand actually is another one that was facing a fiscal crisis, and they were forced to reform and cut back there. And in New Zealand, it's incomplete. You know, it started with the currency crisis in 84, and they made tax reforms, cutting back on those, and labor regulation reforms, which were a big deal. They also, you know, they started off one of the least open countries in the OECD to international trade, moved towards more of an open market. They had free trade with Australia, along with other tariff reductions. Inflation got cut back. But they never really completed their processes. They got some success that kind of tailed off. So that was another one that wasn't, you know, totally backwards, but, you know, made significant strides, but then was incomplete. And I should say Ireland's incomplete, too. While they had that great takeoff, since 2000, really, reforms have stalled and economic freedoms kind of scaled back a little bit in Ireland. In terms of the indexes that measure these things, Ireland's fallen back a little bit. And maybe even worse, as some policymakers in the U.S. are getting the wrong lessons from Ireland. I just wrote one quick paper for someone down in Arizona. Actually, apparently the governor of Arizona and the president of the state university went over to Ireland and found out that it was government subsidization of science technology that caused Ireland's growth. But there was one little inconvenient fact. They didn't create Science Foundation Ireland until 2001, and that's after the growth had already fallen way back.
Well, of course, my concern is for my country, the United States, and really with all the regulations and rules and environmental protection agencies and occupational safety and health regulations and the pattern of taxation here that, although certainly not as bad as in many countries, there's certainly is the potential for raising taxes on our corporation one of these days, and then they pay dividends, and then you tax the dividends again. And down the line, my concern is that if we get back into this tax and tax, spend and spend, and elect approach with ever more regulations as we have today, well, we're going to be in real trouble as a nation right here in America.
Yeah, I agree, and I mean, I think to some extent we're already in trouble. I kind of refer to us as one of the taller dwarfs. I mean, we have more freedom than a lot of the rest of the world, but we could go a lot better, do a lot better than what we're doing here. And it's kind of encouraging worldwide. There's been more of a movement towards greater property rights, private property rights, and economic freedom. But at the same time, in the United States, it seems like policy-wise, or at least kind of falling back in the other direction and getting more and more regulated. It seems like the intellectual battle between socialism and free markets has mostly been decided in favor of markets, but then all of a sudden the policy battle is well behind that.
Well, of course, it was pleasing to me to see so many, professors and economists writing in your book who really are dedicated to these ideas of the free market. Is there a growing movement in support of the free market and private property rights and economic freedom within academia?
I don't know. I mean, within economics, at least, I think, compared to 20 years ago, it looks pretty good. And even in places like these development agencies that seem to always get it wrong, there's at least changes in rhetoric. When I was in D.C. for a while and we did a lot of mini-conferences with some people from World Bank, USAID, and others, they at least would talk about institutions, property rights, rule of law, things that before, instead, they were just kind of doggedly saying aid for investment, aid for infrastructure, aid for education, or what have you. So at least the rhetoric changed a little bit, if not the reality of their policies.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, what do you see down the road as far as Africa is concerned, as far as South America, which are two of the areas that really, of course, have terrible poverty, with so many of the people there living on maybe $2 a day, and that's all they have properly. Half the world lives about $2 a day.
Yeah.
And believe me, $2 doesn't buy what it used to.
Well, here's my optimistic side, actually. Well, I'm fairly pessimistic about where we're headed right now in the U.S. It seems like a lot of the other places, there's a lot of upside potential. In fact, I was rather aggravated. The retirement program at the university I'm at now, it limits what funds you can get into, and I wanted an African mutual fund, not for any short-term plays, but for over the long term. And it's because the upside just keeps getting bigger and bigger. If you think about the West, in particular Great Britain, the United States, how long the process of industrialization and development took us. You're talking 200-year process. But then look what happened with the East Asian tigers over the last 60, 70 years. You know, post-World War II, you get countries essentially who are at the level of development of sub-Saharan Africa. They were about the same then, it's just sub-Saharan Africa hasn't grown. Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, these countries dramatically, two, three generations launched from sub-Saharan African standards to modern industrialized economies. The big difference is there's so much more both knowledge in the world and capital out there, physical capital to go. Once you get your institutions right, the investment flowed in, the foreign investment, and the growth really occurred much more rapidly. And now, the world's advanced so much even farther beyond what we were in 1950 and 1960 that, in these African or Latin American countries, when they get it right, the potential for upside growth, I think, is just getting bigger and bigger.
Well, I certainly agree that, but you qualify that by saying if they get it right. In fact, I was reading something by Jimmy Rogers. I don't know if you know who he is, but he was a partner of George Soros, and he certainly made a name for himself by taking a trip around the world on a bicycle some years ago, on a motorcycle some years ago.
Yeah, this was the investment biker, right?
Yes, the investment biker. But he was simply saying that right now he's pulling everything out of America, the United States. He's putting his money into China. He thinks China and commodities are the two great places that are going to boom. Well, of course, he's a lot smarter than I am. I think it's fascinating. I'm a little reluctant to invest in China. Of course, I don't have any money either as a retired surgeon. I'm just spending 5 hours a day on the radio and not getting paid for it. But I certainly, Africa, how are they ever going to be able to get things going over there? How are they ever going to get responsible people in government? Because in Africa, what I learned when I was there is that most of the areas are tribal, and it's always the strong man who's in control of the strong, ruthless ruler. And as long as you have that, you're not going to be able to have, economic freedom.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think grafting of the modern nation state and its embodiment in all of the regulations and controls is probably incompatible, and it's hard, we can't generalize across the whole continent, but in certainly large areas, is largely going to be incompatible with both indigenous culture and promoting economic freedom. But I think the key there is they're going to have to build off the indigenous networks that they have and the bases. The modern African nation state, it might just be incompatible with the traditional indigenous institutions. And we're going to have more of a move back towards those.
Well, I certainly agree that something's got to be done as far as their structure of government is concerned, because it's usually the head man, the tribal chief, or call him what you will. And we saw that in Kenya, where they had, of course, a contested election, and obviously the ruling class cheated, and now they've got the civil war, they've got chaos, and Kenya was almost a model for Africa, not quite as good as Botswana, but certainly one of the most prosperous nations over there, and now blood's running in the streets, 800 people are dead, and total chaos.
Yeah, Kenya, I was just over there just about a year ago, actually, and what a change. But another place where there's, we often think of it as chaotic in the United States, but other than a recent intervention that went in, it's been doing relatively well and had started to build off of its kind of indigenous institutions, is Somalia. Somalia had one of these, George Aidi refers to as vampire states, where, the rulers just suck the blood out of the country for their own benefit. And after the collapse in 91, there was chaos and civil war for the first 3 or 4 years, in particular while the U.S. and U.N. were still involved in the country. But after we pulled out in 95, there was no longer the potential, really, for an overarching central government to come back. And the clan networks, once they figured out that none of them were going to become the head dog who could exploit everybody else, nor would they get exploited by the others, they settled down into their traditional kind of somewhat of a version of a common law legal system, the Zaire, have used that as their base. And I just published a paper where actually looking at Somali living standards from 90 through 2005, they've actually been improving, not just in absolute terms, but they've been growing faster than the other 42 sub-Saharan African nations. So that's a place where they really kind of fell backwards, but then started using that as something to build from.
Well, of course, what you're really describing is a limited centralized government, so the men could be free, and that's really the secret to freedom, is to limit the power of government over their lives and let people do what they need to do to make a living and to develop themselves and prosper, and that's where prosperity comes from.
Yeah, I certainly agree where prosperity comes from. I wouldn't call what Somalia's done a limited government. In a sense, I'd call it no government in terms of a geographic monopoly. Instead, it's governance. There's not no rule of law, and there's not any lack of enforcement. It's just not a single monopoly that does it, which means basically it's another form of checks and balances. It's a decentralization of checks and balances, where each of the different clan and dispute resolution networks kind of constrain each other. And you could think of it as a form of super checks and balances. And that's what's been limiting the power of coercion there.
Well, because you point out that in most of the places in Africa, the courts are just as corrupt as everybody else. What we really need to do is, I believe, get more moral people and better people. Until you have moral people who fear God, you're never going to be able to have freedom.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not optimistic about getting better people in with the system. I'm kind of a believer in Hayek and why the worst get on top. And the way they compete to get into these positions, I almost guarantee that you won't get a moral person. So I'm more optimistic about maybe dismantling some of the systems and using the internal constraints to limit it.
All right, fine. Well, it's been a fascinating hour. I really appreciate you being on with us, and I think I'd like to get you onto some of our other programs. We actually have four different audiences we do on a regular basis. And our guest has been, of course, Mr. Benjamin Powell, who has edited a book. A number of authors actually wrote in the book, and most of them are experts in their field, talking about whether it would be what's going on in Botswana or Ireland or India or China, and gives you an excellent perspective of what's really going on in the world today. One of the more interesting books that I've read from an economic point of view, that's Making Poor Nations Rich. And once again, what was the website?
Independent.org, either one.
Independent.org. So,
well, thank you for having me on.
God bless, and thanks very much for being with us. Bye-bye. Okay, and I hope you enjoyed the program, Making Poor Nations Rich. Of course, the key to prosperity is freedom, and economic freedom. It'd be nice to have political freedom, but economic freedom is the most important thing, that and private property and the ability to be an entrepreneur.
Through the years of providing water filters to America, you've come to us and we've listened. You asked us to make the water level visible to eliminate the guesswork when refilling the water. We listened. You asked for an elevated base so the system could be used in places beside on the edge of a counter. We listened. You asked us to develop a filter that was made in the USA. We listened. You asked us to include an emergency light for camping and during power outages. We listened. After 9/11, you asked us to develop a filter that was more powerful in removing chemical agents. Again, we listened. Introducing the Berkey Light, the gravity filter requested by America, designed by Americans, and made in America.
Get the Berkey Light, the American water purifier, only $279. Call New Millennium, 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Or order on the web at berkeywater.com. Not yet available in Iowa.
It's a fact. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, all banks in these United States create money out of thin air for every single loan they issue. With never-ending late fees, over-the-limit fees, and higher interest rates, it has become mathematically impossible to repay all debt, making all of us slaves to our creditors. The Federal Debt Relief System has created a successful attorney-backed program to legally eliminate credit card debt, personal loans, lines of credit, and other unsecured debts which have been fraudulently created by the banks. We can terminate your unsecured debt within 18 months with a much lower monthly payment, ending with nothing on your credit report. Join the thousands of Americans who now breathe with a sigh of relief because they have legally eliminated their debt. Instead of living each day in fear and frustration, it's time to take action and turn your life around. Call the Federal Debt Relief System at 877-943-8600. That's 877-943-8600. Or visit FDRS.org. Find out how you can break the cycle of debt slavery. Visit FDRS.org today.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and of course this is the time when I need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and partnering with us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day and during the course of the week on almost 60 different outlets. And believe me, it's an expensive proposition. So again, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Then, of course, let me go ahead and suggest some of the items we have. One of them, of course, is our new little pamphlet we put out called The True Story of 911. And really, of course, we go into the background of the secret organizations that control America and have controlled America for a long period of time. And until you understand, you know, the background of the Bilderbergers, Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, and all of these people, you can't understand anything that's going on. Council on Foreign Relations is a front for a secret society that was created in 1891. How do we know that? Well, because Professor Carol Quigley wrote a book about it. He was Bill Clinton's mentor. It taught at Princeton and Harvard and Georgetown University, and he was totally in favor of these people. Of course, his book was suppressed by the media and by the establishment. They didn't want the American people to know that their great little group, the Council on Foreign Relations, was a front for a secret society, which you'll find out on pages 951 and 952 of the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, 1,342 pages. It's available through Radio Liberty. It's back in print now, although it was actively suppressed for many years. If you don't believe that, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells the story, and you can get either the book by itself, or you can get the Tragedy and Hope special that includes the interview, the book, and, of course, the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, another book that was suppressed because the last thing they want is for the American people to understand that the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Carnegie Foundation were financing Marxism and communism and creating the best enemy money could buy. Well, we've got a great four-tape set on Skull and Bones. And, of course, if you want it in CD, you can get it in CD. But we have the four-tape set. We actually have a number of books. One is by Alexander Robbins. And all the book is really Skull and Bones propaganda. It's got some very good points in it, well worthwhile reading. We're fleshing out of Skull and Bones by Chris Milligan. We have The American Establishment by Professor Sutton. And then we actually have copied the membership list of Skull and Bones. We're not supposed to have that, but we do, and we've published it, and it's available by calling our 800 number. We have a four-tape set on the Bilderbergers now. Nobody else has anything like that. We have an excellent DVD on the Bilderbergers. It's called Endgame, and it's by Alex Jones, and he did a great job on it. And then, of course, we have the two books. One is The Bilderbergers by Daniel Estulin. The other is Bilderberger Diary by James Tucker, who has been tracking them for 25 years, and fascinating, fascinating book. So we have two books, a four-tape set and a DVD on the Bilderbergers. Then if you want to get into the satanic crimes of these people and pedophilia, you want to get the book, Satanic Crimes, or the four-tape set on Satanic Crimes. If you want to know about the Bohemian Grove and the feigned human sacrifice they have there, you'll actually see the ceremonies on the DVD that Alex Jones put out, the secrets of the Bohemian Grove. And then we have a four-tape set on the Bohemian Grove, information you won't get elsewhere. And, of course, we actually have some of the books that they've actually published that are not to be seen by anybody who's not there. And they will tell you that they worship the owl, the 40-foot owl, the replica of Moloch, that ancient demonic symbol, you know, the Luciferian symbol of ages gone past. I don't know how many of the Bohemian Grove members understand what the significance is, but it's up there in the Redwood Grove. So if you'd like to get the four-tape set, like to get the video, why the information's available, and give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Do you know where the 78 potentially active volcanoes in U.S. are located? And do you know the locations of the top 300 prime terrorist targets? You can find these answers and more in the new interactive CD book, Prudent Places USA. With the more than 50 interactive parameters, you can pinpoint natural and man-made disaster areas, brewing environmental catastrophes, the safest cities, the best places for solar and wind energy, and much, much more. Complete with 3 gigabytes of detailed information on each of 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., including 550 high-resolution full-color maps and full-color photographs, as well as detailed information and analysis to help you zero in on the best places to live, the ideal location for cabins and vacation homes, as well as safe and unsafe areas. Get Prudent Places USA for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's probably going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and they're the views of our guests. And today, we hope to have with us Sherwood Ross, and we're going to be talking about the Merchants of Death. And that term really came out after the First World War, when they tried to explain what had happened. I mean, how could you explain the First World War? 21 million people were dead, 40 million people were wounded, a war that didn't make any sense. The Germans blamed the English blamed the Germans. The Germans had tried to stop the war, and the English wouldn't let them. And as a result of World War I, why, there was a Russian Revolution and the implementation of communism. There was a revolution in Germany that led to Adolf Hitler. There was a revolution in Turkey, and of course there was a revolution in Italy, and there was just an overthrow of the entire existing structure of the world. But how did you explain it? Well, of course, initially the explanation was very, very simple. Since what happened didn't make any sense, and there had to be a logical explanation, it was the merchants of death. It was the arms manufacturers, because they sold weapons to both sides, that they made money, and no matter who won the war, it was the Merchants of Death, and there were books written at that time by that title. And, of course, there were a lot of people who honestly believed that. They did not understand that the war had been created to bring about the League of Nations, because the slogans for the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy. And what people didn't know is that for 3,000 years, the secret society has been working to bring about world democracy, not republics where men could be free, as they were in America, but to transform every country into a democracy where you could manipulate the politicians, and the politicians would be controlled by the ruling elite, and that's what it was really all about. But of course, the munitions manufacturers, the arms merchants are working today. And of course, the largest supplier of weapons anywhere in the world is the United States. The Russians are probably the second largest supplier of weapons. And we are arming the whole world right now. We're selling massive amounts of sophisticated weaponry and guided bombs to Saudi Arabia. Who do you think they're going to use those sophisticated weapons and guided bombs on? Or do you think they're going to attack Kuwait? Of course not. They're going to use it against Israel. But don't you worry, we're going to supply weapons to Israel as well. In fact, we arm both sides in every war, whether the Iranian-Iraqi war in the 1980s, and we were arming the Iraqis, we were arming the Iranians. It's the oldest game in the world. And, of course, that's how you get chaos. Sherwood, are you there?
Yes, how are you, Dr. Stan?
I'm doing fine. I'm going to let you pick up the story because you've written a wonderful article about the arms merchants.
Well, thank you. You know, you mentioned Israel just now. The United States has allowed Israel to buy between 500 and 600 war planes from us. And those planes have been used, you know, to attack Lebanon and other countries with really tremendous damage.
And of course, one of the interesting things about that, we pretty well destroyed large segments of Lebanon, And then the wealthy financiers are coming in, they're going to build that whole thing up, going to make tremendous profits. Wealthy financiers from Saudi Arabia. And if Israel hadn't destroyed it with the planes we gave them, how could our good friends in Saudi Arabia have rebuilt that and made those tremendous profits down the line? So you had to understand, question yourself, why in heaven's name, did Israel do what it did and attack civilian areas rather than the military areas? But when you understand, there's always a reason. Sometimes nobody will ever tell you. Go ahead.
Well, the warplanes which Israel gets, they have been buying from America for $45 million each. But the American taxpayers are really paying for it because we give Israel...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
$2 billion.
Go right ahead.
$2 billion a year.
Actually, it's $3 billion, I thought.
But anyway, $3 billion.
It's $3 billion, and then, we give $3 billion to Egypt so they can buy weapons to attack Israel. We give Israel $3 billion so they can buy weapons to defend themselves against Egypt. And
you would think that the American taxpayers would want to spend that money in America.
But, of course, we don't, because our leaders have a different agenda than the average American.
Well, they do have a different agenda, and their agenda, I believe, is to get the oil of the Middle East. So many of the leaders in the Bush administration have been tied into the oil lobby. They are part of the warp and woof of this oil lobby structure. Dick Cheney was a member of Kazakhstan's oil advisory board, and... Kazakhstan has huge oil and gas reserves, and Bush called Kazakhstan a free nation, but it hasn't had an election since it left the Soviet Union in 1991. And Cheney says, "Oh well, they're making progress," and the United States now is giving Kazakhstan military assistance.
But, of course, all of those countries over there are dictatorships, whether it be Turkmenistan or whether it be Uzbekistan. They're all dictatorships, and we're backing all of them. But we're backing dictatorships all throughout the world today. And the average American just doesn't understand that we're backing dictators in South America. We're backing dictators in Africa. We're backing dictatorship over there in Central Asia. And the American people honestly think that somehow we're interested in establishing democracy.
Well, now we've got a defense budget, and it's really not defense. It's basically an offense budget. You don't have a defense budget when you've got 700 military bases in 130 foreign countries. You don't have a defense budget when you've got 1,000 more military bases in the United States. We've got nearly 2,000 military bases around the globe. Who needs it? Nobody else has got anything like it. I mean, it's the idea that it's the American century that we're going to rule the world. And how different is that from Hitler's idea or Genghis Khan's idea that they're going to go out and conquer everything and that they were the self-appointed policemen for the world?
Well, I think, Sherwood, you're absolutely right. But the difficulty is they've never told the American people what the real basis of our foreign policy is. That we are, of course, going to establish an American empire. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sherwood was just pointing out that the United States has, troops stationed on about over 700 bases in 130 nations throughout the world. That doesn't count the bases here. We spend more money on the American military establishment than all the rest of the countries in the world put together. Why are we doing this? Well, very simply, the real purpose of American foreign policy has nothing to do with defending America. It has to do with establishing a world government, a world empire, and America. The people who control our government, the globalists who control our government, are using the military and financial power of our government to bring all nations of the world under control, and any ruler out there who doesn't want to go along with it, well, of course, he will either be removed or will be executed. And that's what the CIA does. It kills foreign leaders. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, or certainly some of the reports that came out of the Church Committee about how our CIA was assassinating world leaders. But, of course, nobody was going to point out that this is all part of the plan to bring about world government. And as Sherwood has written a wonderful article. It's published at newswithviews.com. And he's simply pointing out how we are funding both sides in most of the struggles throughout the world today. Sherwood, go right ahead.
Well, what you brought out about the CIA has got to be seen as an American Gestapo, because that, it's a cancer on our democracy. According to the Global Policy Forum, between 1960 and 2004, the CIA attempted to overthrow or succeeded in overthrowing 40 different governments around the world. They overthrew the Congo in 1960, Laos in 62, Ecuador in 63, Brazil in 64, Indonesia 65, Ghana 66, Cambodia 69, Chile 73, and Haiti 2004. And that's just some of them.
Well, of course, you didn't mention, of course, in 1953, the CIA overthrew the democratically elected premier of Iran, a man named Mossadegh.
And that was after he nationalized the oil company.
Yes, sir. And then, of course,
so there's your motive again.
And then in 1979, they overthrew the Shah of Iran. It was the CIA that did it and brought the wicked Ayatollahs to power. Why would we have done something like that? And now we're talking about going to war with the wicked Ayatollahs. People really don't understand what's going on in the world today. And the great tragedy is that most people simply accept what they read in the newspapers or what they hear our leaders say, and never stop and question why these things are going on. And why do we need, you know, our troops in 130 nations throughout the world?
Well, and why? One of the blowbacks of American foreign policy, and I don't know if the American people have put it together, but there are global boycotts in progress against American manufactured goods, American movies, anything that the United States sells. There are people all over the world, and I get letters from everywhere, Australia and other as far away as Australia, that they won't buy American products. And why is it that General Motors is, you know, having a difficult time overseas? You know, there are people in Europe, they have a choice between buying a Honda and buying a Chevrolet. They're going to pick a Honda.
And I really think, Bruce, but the average American doesn't like to hear this because they love America, as I love America. But the foreign policy that has been imposed upon us by the globalists, and they come from these covert organizations who have no loyalty to America. They want a world government. They want to destroy our sovereignty. But their policies are wreaking havoc throughout the world today, as they're wreaking havoc in the Middle East, as they're wreaking havoc in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Africa, and in Latin America. And people don't like being told what to do. They want to be free, and we don't want them to be free. In fact, we're doing everything we can in Europe to unite Europe in the European Union. This was an American program. This wasn't primarily a European program. We want to unite Europe and take away their sovereignty. We want to unite North America and take away our sovereignty.
Now that the Soviet threat is pretty much gone, there's not really a reason to maintain the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And the United States not only maintains it, but keeps expanding it so it gets closer and closer to the borders of Russia.
But, of course, the thing is that this really is the world government's world army, and that's why it's over there in Afghanistan fighting today. Why is NATO fighting in Afghanistan? Why? Because they're the world army from the world government, and they were sent there by the United Nations. But we can't let the American people know that or even question what they're being told by the controlled media.
Well, one reason they're fighting in Afghanistan is because the United States, you know, wanted to lay a pipeline across Afghanistan. In fact, two pipelines, a natural gas pipeline and an oil pipeline. That was sought by Union Oil Company of California. I mean, read the book, The Sorrows of Empire by Chalmers Johnson, a great historian. It's all in there. And the Taliban didn't want it. Taliban didn't want American-owned pipeline. And I believe that's the real reason Afghanistan was attacked.
Well, Chris,
not to get Osama bin Laden. And, you know, they never did get Osama bin Laden. Why not? Because they really didn't care.
I think you're absolutely right. We never tried to get Osama bin Laden. And I think your point is so well taken, Sherwood. If we went into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and he escaped into Pakistan, then why didn't we attack Pakistan or send our troops in and say we're going to get him? Why are we still fighting in Afghanistan today if we went in there to get Osama bin Laden? Osama bin Laden not hiding there. And, of course, we're funding the Pakistan government that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys over there. In other words, we're funding both sides of this and, of course, killing the NATO troops there. But we need that war. It's a great diversion. And, of course, one of these days, why we will win the war and then we'll build our pipeline across there. But right now we need the diversion. That's why we're not trying to really end the war.
Well, as General MacArthur once noted, he said that the American people seem to have been told about one emergency after another that requires this big military expenditure. And MacArthur, who was, you know, an American general of some eminence, said at one point the hundreds of billions of dollars now spent in mutual preparedness, meaning the U.S. and USSR, could conceivably abolish poverty from the face of the earth. You know, I don't understand why the Peace Corps and the Pentagon don't switch budgets. I would love to see the Peace Corps out doing good around the world rather than the Pentagon.
Well, of course, the problem is that we need a powerful military force to bring about the world government, Sherwood. That's what it's really all about. We need to be able to crush opposition to this idea of world government, and the American military has been used for that. Our boys are not, you know, fighting for freedom, they're fighting to advance this cause, the New World Order, the New World Government, the New World Religion.
I think they call it, conservative Republicans, and I don't want to say all Republicans, but there is a conservative group that talks about the New American Century.
Because that's the neocons, they're no more conservative than Hillary Clinton.
Well, they're radical.
Of course they're radicals, and they're totally dedicated to this. And, you know, all you need to do is read their writings. You can find it at newamericancentury.org, newamericancentury.org. They will tell you back in, you know, 2 or 3 years before the 9/11 attack that we had to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And of course, in 2000, they wrote something. It's all up there on their website, newamericancentury.org. And there it basically talks in this pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And they say we're going to have to, first of all, have an incident like another Pearl Harbor to get this accomplished.
Right.
And then we're going to keep our troops there indefinitely, whether Saddam Hussein is in power or not. It's always been intentionally to permanently occupy Iraq, just as we keep our...
Well, McCain said the other day that he would stay in Iraq for 100 years if he had to.
And how can the American people be voting for John McCain, and yet an awful lot of Republicans are going to do it, unfortunately?
Well, yeah. I mean, why doesn't he make Iraq the 51st state, and then they can go after Iran and make it the 52nd state?
Well, unfortunately, the American people have allowed this to happen because they've not been willing to find out what's really going on and do the study and the work. And all you have to do is go to the neocon website, newamericancentury.org.
Well, it's a war for oil. That's what it's all about. You know, when King George attacked the United States, when he sent the redcoats in, somebody said, questioned him and said, why is King George sending the redcoats in against the colonists? They really haven't done anything. And then somebody else answered, their crime is property. And the crime of the people in Iraq and Iran is that they're sitting on huge oil deposits. That's their crime.
All right, fine. Well, what about the idea of these arms sales throughout the world? Because that was what your article was really about.
Yeah, well, the United States has been a leader for years in selling arms. You know, this has gone on under Bill Clinton. It's going on under George Bush. It went on under George Bush the first. And my information comes from, you know, a very reliable source, the Center for Defense Information, which tracks this data. And they say that the United States sold $17 billion worth of new arms in 2006, and that's 42% of all the arms sold in the world, you know, and it was twice as much as Russia, and five times as much as Great Britain.
But, of course, these arms are going to be used for war. They're going to be used to suppress the people and the hopes and aspirations of people for freedom. Why would we, if we're really interested in democracy, be arming governments so they could oppress their people? We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, sure, we'd go ahead and pick up the idea there. And certainly I get the information from the Center for Defense Information as well. And they have certainly pointed out that the United States puts out more money for its military forces than all the rest of the world put together.
Right. You know, who are we afraid of? McCain talks about Islamo-fascists, but this is just the latest bogeyman, if you ask me. We are deliberately creating Islamo-fascists. I mean, they've got thousands of people picked up in dragnet arrests, hundreds of them in Guantanamo. Dick Cheney's or Rumsfeld said they're the worst of the worst, you know. And it turns out that hundreds of them, they've had to free them because they had no case against them.
But, of course, when
they weren't Islamo-fascists. They were taxi drivers picked up on the streets of Kabul, for pity's sake.
But, of course, Sherwood, what you have to understand is when those people get home, they will have an intense hatred for America. And they will spread that hatred for America, and which is being used to recruit people into this radical Islamic movement throughout the world.
Well, yeah.
This was not a problem before the United States and the MI6 began financing this radical movement. And anybody who doubts that, we carry a book called The Devil's Game, pointing out how the British started financing the Muslim Brotherhood back in 1928, but the CIA picked it up after the Second World War. And we financed this whole movement of Al-Qaeda. We brought these Arabs from all over the world to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets. And we indoctrinated them with this concept. It was wonderful to die for Allah, because if you died for Allah, you'd go to heaven and get 72 virgins. Most of the Arabs had never thought of these things until these ideas were planted in their minds by the CIA and by the USAID, which spent, that's the United States.
Well, the Native Americans had never scalped their enemies until the French Canadians said that they wanted scalps back. They went into the colonies. George Bush as much as invited Al-Qaeda to come into Iraq. I mean, he said, bring them on. And Laura Bush at the time said to him, George, what did you say that for? Well, there's a reason, and that reason is that he wants to perpetuate a war in Iraq. He has no intention of getting out. And I'm afraid McCain is of the same mindset. He won't get out either. And any Democrat who says that they want to get out, they're called softies. They're called traitors. They're called letting our troops down. You know, when we have no business being there in the first place, 70% of the Iraqis polled don't want us there. I mean, haven't we done enough damage? I don't hear a single presidential contender talk about the wreckage and havoc that the United States has brought to Iraq.
Well, there's one who does, and that's Ron Paul. He says we ought to come home. The reason, of course, that the Muslims attacked us was because we were over there in their country attacking them.
Right. Well, what about the reconstruction of Iraq? What about 2 million people who've been forced out of their homes? You know, the tremendous unemployment, the destruction to the infrastructure. George Bush promised 3 years ago, he said, oh, Iraq, when we're done there, they'll have the best infrastructure in the Middle East. Well, that certainly has not happened. I mean, Americans are afraid to get out of the green zone. I mean, it takes a lot of courage on the part of our troops.
Hold that right. Hold that right there, Sherwood. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sherwood, of course, is talking about what's going on over in Iraq, and of course, the tragedy of what's unfolding over there, where somewhere between 600,000 and 1,250,000 Iraqis have been killed in this tragic situation. Some of them have been killed by the Civil War. But then who precipitated the Civil War? Why, the American did. Paul Bremer, sent from Washington, D.C., a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, close to Henry Kissinger, is sent over to Iraq immediately after we were victorious and our military was about to wrap things up and of course, use the Iraq military and the Iraq police force and the Iraq civil service to keep the society stable and keep the jobs there, the factories, get the factories open. And what does Paul Bremer do? Why, he disbands the Iraqi army, disbands the Iraqi police force, fires all the people, the entire civil service, the people who create the electricity and the water and the sewage, and then he closes down all the factories, puts hundreds of thousands of people out of work, at least 100,000, closes the hospitals because there might be somebody there who backs Saddam Hussein, closes the schools because there might be a member of the Ba'athist Party, and totally destroys the infrastructure of the society. And then people wonder why you had chaos over there and why people who would get paid for joining, in the insurgency, and believe me, you had no way to finance your family, wouldn't you join the insurgents as well? And, of course, where was the money coming from? Why, our good friends in Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia paying Al-Qaeda, paying the insurgents, who were then killing our men. But people can't understand that.
Well, you know, the American people, I believe, are really basically very generous. The church groups will go out, and a couple of days a week they'll feed the homeless, they'll help the hungry, they'll have clothing drives, canned food drives. People are basically generous, but they can't visualize. They can't visualize the damage that has been done in Iraq and the damage that's been done in Afghanistan. I mean, 78,000 civilians killed by aerial bombing in Iraq from American and British warplanes. You know, they can't envision that. And so they don't think in terms of the billions and billions of dollars that I think we owe the people of Iraq for the restoration of their country. I mean, where is the Judeo-Christian spirit?
Well, of course, we've appropriated a great deal of money to rebuild Iraq, but most of that money sort of disappeared, on no-bid contracts to friends of Dick Cheney.
Why did it ever disappear? Right. I mean, they took $8 billion right at the beginning under Paul Bremer. That was part of, that was in Iraqi hands, and they distributed it. Nobody knows where it went.
And of course,
there is no accounting for it. You know, that $8 bucks just disappeared.
Just like the 200,000 weapons, you know, pistols, rifles. They just sort of disappeared. We have no idea what happened to them. Oh, shucks, I guess we're just so inefficient.
Right, and these small arms sales, we're making these small arms sales all over the world, and there are so many insurgencies being fought with these small arms.
In fact,
that's one of the points that the Center for Defense Information and the Arms Control Association make, that it's not necessarily nuclear bombs that are being deployed. They're these small arms, and their impact is absolutely devastating, particularly on civilian populations. There was one country in South America, I forget which it was, but their government was being overthrown. And the insurgents were rolling into the capital in Sherman tanks. And where did they get them from? They got them from the United States.
I think it's important. The center of it is the Defense Information is a very liberal organization. But what most people don't understand is the globalists control both the left and the right. They finance both sides. They would finance people from the Center for Defense Information. They'd finance the people who are patriotic and behind the war. And until people begin to understand that they could control both sides and we're constantly being manipulated, literally nothing that's going on today makes sense. They're behind the anti-war movement. They're behind the pro-war movement and patriotism. And, of course, they're using patriotism to justify staying in the no-win war in Iraq. And if you doubt that this is a no-win war, you need to get my December letter, which is simply the text of a speech given by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who commanded the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003 to June of 2004. And his conclusion, the best we can hope for is not to be defeated, because, of course, we're not allowed to win. Read my December newsletter if you'd like to get a free copy. We'll be glad to send it to you. And the tragedy is most Americans have never heard of it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Sherwood Frost. Sherwood, go right ahead.
Well, a long time ago, a famous American said, "The continual necessity for their services enhances the importance of the soldier and proportionally degrades the condition of the free citizen. The military state becomes elevated above the civil." And those are the words of Alexander Hamilton. And I happen to believe them. Hamilton was a profound thinker, and he could size up the situation. Jefferson later opposed the United States having a navy because he saw the British Navy literally dictating British foreign policy. And the British Navy would say, well, we would like to go over and attack this country or attack that fleet. And the whole empire, of course, was dragged into that. So here we have a military establishment on which we are spending more than Social Security. You know, the military budget is bigger than Social Security, bigger than Medicare and Medicaid put together. You know, and it's 30 times, 40 times as high as everything we spend on energy, and we need to develop new sources of energy. So here we have a military establishment which is really calling the shots. We have never before had anything this powerful or this detrimental to our democracy. And if you're critical of it, they say you're not patriotic. But America was not designed to become a warfare state, and we have become a warfare state, and we are very dangerous, and the man in the White House has got his finger on the nuclear trigger with 10,000 nuclear warheads that could wipe out all life on the planet Earth. Has the power of 130,000 Hiroshima-type atomic bombs. And you've got candidates in this election who won't rule out using the nuclear weapon. I mean, that has to be pretty close to insanity, because even using a small nuclear weapon is going to degrade the environment, is going to endanger many countries.
Well, of course, Sherwood, I sometimes think we live in a world gone mad. Other times, I'm absolutely certain. And Sherwood is certainly pointing out the fact that if there is a very real danger of a nuclear war, and I would like to second what he's saying. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Sherwood Ross, and he, of course, writes for newswithviews.com and had written an excellent article on I call them the merchants of death, but the armed merchants who are selling weapons all throughout the world today. And most of those weapons are produced in the United States. And you have to understand that to question what your government is doing is not unpatriotic when your government has been taken over by people who have a different agenda, a different worldview than the average American, and are working covertly to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and merge us into a one-world state. Sherwood, do you have a website or any information you'd like to get out?
Well, anybody can read what I write by going to Sherwood. r1 at yahoo.com, or they can look up my articles on Op-Ed News. I've got an article on radioactive ammunition coming out in a new book from Clarity Press that will be out later this month. It's a book called The Illusions of War. Clarity Press is a little publisher in Atlanta.
Now, are you talking about the depleted uranium shells?
Yes.
All right. Fine. I hope you'll give me a copy of that, sir, and maybe we can do a program on it, because I think it's so vitally important that our listeners know that we're not only poisoning the landscape over there in Iraq, but we're poisoning our own soldiers. And what, again, was your website? Give that one more time.
SherwoodR1 at yahoo.com.
SherwoodR1
at numeral 1 at yahoo.com.
At yahoo.com. Okay, fine. All right, fine. And so you can go there and pull down Sherwood's articles, and certainly they're well-written, and this one on the arms sales, I think, was very, very important. It is unpatriotic not to question when your government is doing something wrong, and to insist on sending our boys over to fight in another no-win war, like the no-win war we fought in Korea, like the no-win war we fought in Vietnam, like the no-win war the Cubans fought at the Bay of Pigs, not allowed to win, and then now the no-win war we're fighting in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Why would anybody who cares about our service people or cares about America want to perpetuate a no-win war? We've been fighting, you know, in Afghanistan far longer, almost 2 years longer than we fought in the Second World War. Why don't we win the war and get it over? Well, if we did, how could we justify staying?
Somebody is making money in Afghanistan, Dr. Stan. I mean, the poppy crop is at an all-time high.
Isn't that amazing? We control the country, and we just can't do anything about that. Those terrible people who are growing the heroin.
We can't find the poppies,
right,
Dr. Stan. You don't understand. We've got 18 intelligence agencies with a budget of $50 billion a year. We've got spy satellites in the sky. We've got boots on the ground, intelligence agents on the ground, and they cannot find these poppy crops.
And yet it's 90% of all everything.
They're the largest in the world.
All
Why
right.
not?
Well, of course, because the war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. The largest purveyor of heroin in the world is our own Central Intelligence Agency, and anybody who doubts that needs to read the book, long suppressed, called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. We actually have copies of that, secondhand copies, but we want you, of course, to read it. It was actually written by a woman who worked for CBS, and her husband certainly is one of my favorite authors, William Stevenson, who's written wonderful books.
The CIA, in addition to what budget it gets from the taxpayers, has got this money coming in on the side from black operations.
Right.
And I don't mean to use the term black as a pejorative. Let me say illegal operations.
And, of course, even the Inspector General came out with a report, which we got, talking about, of course, how the CIA was involved in drug smuggling during the Nicaraguan War. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you'd like, of course, to clarify what I'm saying about the CIA and drugs, the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson. She actually got the copyright back because the publisher would not keep the book in print. I went to Canada where they printed up, 5,000 copies of the book, which were all accidentally shredded. Just accidentally, they fell into a shredder and they were all shredded. And other than the books we have, which we get off of Amazon, we buy them and offer them to you. Why is the book not available? We have the book, of course, Defrauding America, Drugging America, four tape sets on this. You must understand that, of course, the CIA doesn't need any funds at all. They make a lot of money by smuggling drugs, and that's why we're not stopping the drugs that are being grown in Afghanistan, which is being occupied by America today.
Well, Dr. Stan, if I may interject here, part of this fault, a large part of this fault, I'm sorry to say this, is the fault of the American people. There are Americans, for example, who are working in defense industries, and they don't want to lose their jobs, and I don't blame them. But you look at what New York City did at the Brooklyn Naval Yard, how they converted that from wartime to a peacetime footing. I mean, you would think that the people who are making atomic bombs out in Amarillo, Texas, you know, would rather be doing something else for the benefit of humanity. But, and you've got people who are working for the big defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, United Technologies, General Electric, the Carlyle Group. These companies are making billions, and they're employing lots and lots of workers. I don't know what the whole total is. But the American public needs to say, we've had enough of this. You know, we have allegedly a Judeo-Christian tradition in this country, and I think the Sermon on the Mount stood for something. You know, blessed be the peacemakers. So I think that's important, and the American people have got to start asking the questions. It doesn't begin at the top with George Bush. He'll never ask any questions of his policies. You know, I think Cheney tells him what to do when he does it. But the rest of us have got to question in our own lives how we want to live. And who is at the other end of that machine gun we're making? Or who is at the other end of that destroyer that we are sending down the waves at Newport News? Who is at the other end of the radioactive ammunition? I mean, there are people suffering and dying, and the American people aren't questioning their own role in it.
And, of course, for anybody who doesn't know anything about depleted uranium, we have a wonderful DVD called Beyond Treason, and with that you get a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of government regulations and government documents to show that the people in Washington, D.C. know how dangerous depleted uranium is. They just don't want our service people who are being poisoned, and many of them poisoned for life and will die of the complications of depleted uranium, as the people in Iraq are dying today. But we can't let the American people know the truth. And Beyond Treason, an excellent DVD, and the government documents, which, of course, they did not want the American people to see. After all, if you knew what was going on over there, maybe some Americans might say, well, maybe I ought to be involved and try to stop what's happening, not only to the people of Iraq, but to our own soldiers. And for every soldier who comes home, why, one in three soldiers who come home for the current war are ill within 3 months. I wonder why. Oh, go ahead, Sherwood.
Well, I think in part you're also referring to Gulf War syndrome
right
here.
Or some of the, whatever the Gulf War syndrome is, they're using our boys for experimentation. Anybody who doubts that, we have a report that came out from the Senate Veterans Committee back in 1994. We called it a Rockefeller Committee report, but it's really a Veterans Committee report over the name of Jay Rockefeller, Senator Jay Rockefeller.
Dr. Stan, it's not just our soldiers, it's our own people.
I know, but of course this report talks about how they've experimented on hundreds of thousands of American soldiers without their knowledge and consent, and many of them became seriously ill.
Right, and what
some
about
of them
the
died.
Atomic bomb testing back in the 50s?
And that was part of that, what they're talking about, and of course the things that are going on today. And of course this was after the Gulf War. They were talking about the Gulf War syndrome in this publication, pointing out that between 40% and 60% of the wives of the ill veterans, 46% of the wives were coming down with the same illness that the government says doesn't exist.
Well, not only have there been a rise in miscarriages on the part of the wives of returning Gulf War veterans, but there have also been comparable miscarriages in Iraq among Iraqi women.
Sure.
And children who are being hideously deformed with their, some of them with their organs outside their bodies, you know, their livers on the outside instead of on the inside. I mean, these are grotesque abnormalities that are associated with radioactive poisoning.
But, of course, you will never see this on American media. They don't want the American people to know, and since they control the media, well, these are the stories you're never going to either hear, and certainly the pictures you're never going to see.
Well, there was an article in a scholarly journal, and I'm going to mention here the fact that it is published by my client, the Massachusetts School of Law at Andover. They publish a journal called the Long-Term Review, and they had an article by a woman named Pulaski. I forget her first name, but she was talking about how the Iraq War is presented as infotainment for the American people. It's not... You don't see all the blood. You don't see the dead children. You don't see all the gore. It's presented as infotainment, and Americans think it's some kind of video show. During the shock and awe bombing of Iraq, Americans saw missiles going down and pinpointing and blowing up bridges. The American public was never told that 90% of the ordnance dropped in Iraq was not pinpointed missiles. I mean, they're just old-fashioned bombs that were being dropped everywhere, and not necessarily on military sites, I'm sorry to say.
Well, of course, the great tragedy is that the mind, the reality of the American people is shaped by the media. And if you control the media, why, you control what the American people hear, what the American people see, what the American people read, and ultimately what the American people believe. And that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day. And certainly, Sherwood, I know you're trying to get the truth out to the American people. And so I certainly appreciate everything you're doing.
I appreciate what you're doing. I know reporters who think the way I do and who are writing columns and who have lost their columns, and they find that other newspapers don't want to run their columns because they are strongly opposed to the war in Iraq. You know, I know these people. I have been in media for many, 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 many years. And when I wrote business columns for a wire service, I mean, my byline has been in just about every paper in the United States of America. But when I send out something from what I call my anti-war news service, editors do not run it. And, of course, sometimes they have many better sources than mine. But just generally speaking, it's a major difference. You can write a good business story and it'll get printed. But it is very difficult to attack the Iraq War because newspapers are not publishing it, publishing both sides.
Well, of course, the thing is that the editors want to keep their jobs, and they understand that if they tell the truth, they're going to be looking for a job, too. And so they want to keep their jobs. And unfortunately, this is the way that it really is within the media. I'm sure many of the reporters, you know, over there send back good articles, but they just will never see the light of day.
Yeah, one of the points that this professor Pulaski made in her article on infotainment is that surveys were made during the Iraq War, and they were made of guests who appeared on television, pro and con, and the television networks put on the pro-war people 90% of the time, and they only put on the anti-war people 10% of the time. So you have a tremendous distortion. I believe the American people are hungry for peace. You know, I think we all need it, and we can all profit from it, and we can all live at peace with ourselves and the world. But our government doesn't want that condition to prevail.
Well, I think people have to understand that the government is not answerable to the people. There is a secret government that really controls both political parties and makes mockery out of our electoral process. And when you've got a choice between John McCain and Hillary Clinton, who do you want? It's like a choice between being shot or being hung. I mean, which one do you really want?
Well, I mean, nobody controlled Dennis Kucinich, and nobody controls Ron Paul, as far as I can see.
No,
they don't. They don't get much play in the media, though.
They sure don't. Poor Dennis was forced to drop out. He didn't even have any, you know, any money. But certainly, there's been a groundswell of support for Ron Paul, and actually, he and Kucinich look at many things the same way. They did not look at the function of government, but certainly Ron Paul wanted to cut government and Kucinich wanted to increase it, but they both looked at the war the same way and the corruption the same way. But Dennis was simply forced to drop out. Fortunately, Ron Paul is still running And, of course, he has enough money to hang on in there. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens today. This may
well,
very
you know,
well...
It, Dr. Stan, it's an old canard that, you know, politicians come in and they say they're going to cut government. But the day Ronald Reagan left office, the U.S. government had more employees on its payroll than the day Ronald Reagan walked into the White House.
But you know, when Ronald Reagan got into the White House, he made a deal with the Democrats. If they'd vote for his budget, he'd deliver every Republican congressman. And every Republican congressman compromised their principles. And for one, it was Ron Paul who was called to the White House, and Reagan brought him into the Oval Office and said, Ron, don't you have confidence in me? Don't you want to support me? I've made a promise. I've given my word that every Republican congressman would vote for my program. And Ron Paul said, sir, I stand behind everything you say and everything you stand behind, but I can't back this budget, and I will not back this budget because it's against everything you stand for. And he was the only Republican congressman who voted against Republican Ronald Reagan's budget there during the first year of his...
Well, you know, the Bush deficit for 2008 for this year is $410 billion.
Right. But I will tell you, Ron Paul, at 99% of the time, has voted against increased government spending. He's a man of principle. I've known him. I've followed his career for 40 years. We're lucky to have men like that. And whether he wins or loses, and he'll probably lose, he has actually captured the imagination of many of our young people who want to be free. And what he's talking about is getting back to our Constitution and limiting the power of government. And
well, it sure needs to be limited.
Amen to that. Well, hang on here. We'll be back in just a moment with Sherwood Ross to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Sherwood, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, if I could wrap up this program, I would say that, speaking from my heart, I believe very strongly in the Sermon on the Mount, and I believe in nonviolence. I was in the civil rights movement, and I saw it work, and I know the power of nonviolence, and I know the power of peace. And the basic principles of America were for a new nation that would stand for peace. We didn't follow those principles very long. We made a war against Mexico, and Abraham Lincoln stood up on the floor of Congress, and he denounced the war against Mexico. And later, General Grant told the Emperor of Japan he should have resigned his commission rather than fight Mexico. So we have made mistakes along the way. But what's happening now in the Middle East is a colossal crime against humanity. And the president and his advisors and the torturers and the killers who believe in war and force and violence need to be removed from office. And I also believe they need to be tried and prosecuted for their crimes. And I'm sorry, very sorry to have to say this, that this has happened in my lifetime. But the only way you can go forward is if you can punish those who are responsible for their crimes and their wrongdoing, and then move ahead with new people who are committed to basic principles of humanity.
But I don't see any of them running for president other than Ron Paul today. That's the tragedy, and I don't think he's going to win the election, but I think it's going to be fascinating to see how many Americans will rally to his cause. And, of course, you know, I happen to believe, as an evangelical Christian, that, you know, if people are not punished in this life, they certainly will be punished in the next life. And how these people can profess to be Christians and do what they're doing, I don't know. But one day they're going to stand behind before the throne of judgment and be called, you know, to answer for what they've done. So our job is, of course, to get the truth out to the American people. I think you're doing a great job. I congratulate you on what you're doing. Give me a copy of your book when it comes out, Sherwood.
And, thanks so much, Dr.
And certainly we will go ahead and do a program on it, because I think it's so important to get the information out on the depleted uranium that is destroying the lives not only of the Iraqis and the unborn generations of Iraqis, but here in the United States, the lives of American soldiers and the lives of their unborn children. Sherwood, God bless you. Thanks very much for being
here. And you too.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, our guest has been Sherwood Ross, who's certainly been writing for a long period of time. He feels very deep. Well, Dr. Stan, I hope you enjoyed our interview with Sherwood Ross. And of course, you may agree with him, you may not agree with him. But I am deeply concerned that God does judge nations. And how you can justify going into a war when even the president admits that the supposition that brought us into the war was wrong. And then, of course, nobody is punished. Nobody is demoted. Nobody is asked to resign from office because they gave the wrong information. And perhaps as many as a million Iraqis are dead. And nobody's responsible. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, somebody is responsible. And it's all being covered up. And our boys are over there fighting. It is a no-win war. They're not being allowed to win. And don't believe what I say. You can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for a copy of our December 2007 newsletter, the speech of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who is in command there for a year, coalition forces for a year. And he will tell you the best we can hope for is not to be defeated. The best we can hope for is not to be defeated. And as he says, in many, many ways, because we're not allowed to win this war. And the administration and the National Security Agency and the State Department will not allow us to do what's necessary to win this war. And our boys are dying. Those are his words, not mine. The speech by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez in October of last year, and you will have a very difficult time finding it on the internet, as I did. It took me an hour to track it down. But we've actually published this in our December newsletter. Read it and weep. And, of course, it will be posted on the internet. I'll see that it's put up there today, if it's not already there. And that's the December 2007 Radio Liberty letter. But you see, it's the same thing as happened in Vietnam. We didn't go there to win. Our boys were not allowed to win. I personally talked to Ambassador William H. Sullivan, the ambassador to Laos, who was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and to Lieutenant General Lewis Walt. Both of them told me, four-star Marine general, we could have won in 2 months. We were not allowed to win the war. In fact, if you've read the rules of engagement, we weren't even allowed to bomb the MiG fighters that were on the ground in North Vietnam. We couldn't fire on those planes until they were in the air shooting down our boys. And, of course, the equipment that was being used to kill our boys, most of it came from Russia, and we were financing the Russians who were providing weapons for the North Vietnamese, who were providing weapons for the South Vietnamese and Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. And what's going on over in Afghanistan today is, well, it's Vietnam all over again. We weren't allowed to win in Korea. It was a no-win war. Understand, but nobody's telling people this. That's why you need to get the information. You need, of course, to get a copy of this program and so many of our other programs on Vietnam. Get our programs on, certainly on what's going on in Iraq today. You need to get my pamphlets entitled The True Story of 9-1-1. You need to get our series of pamphlets, three of them, Foreknowledge 9-1-1. And understand, of course, that they knew the attack was coming, but they wanted an incident, and that's exactly what Condoleezza Rice says, and we have their testimony before the 911 Commission. We told them, we need a catastrophic event. We need a catastrophic event. That's why we didn't do anything beforehand. We needed a catastrophic event if people were going to change their attitudes, change their culture, change their attitude towards domestic intelligence. And, of course, that's what it's all about. They're using, of course, the threat of a terrorist attack to take away our freedom. And of course, they are actually, you know, tapping telephones, not on the terrorists. They have the ability now to listen on your cell phone, even though it's turned off. They can listen to your conversations. They can trap you, even if it's turned off. If you need the documentation, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection, because we're involved in a spiritual battle. for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And there are powerful spiritual forces out there working through secret societies. And believe me, the Council on Foreign Relations is the front for a secret society. Get Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope. Till tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
With news on the Information Radio Network, I'm Greg Moore. On this Super Tuesday, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton cast her vote in New York. Correspondent Warren Levinson was there.
Hillary Clinton cast her vote at home in the New York City suburb of Chappaqua, shaking hands, greeting neighbors, signing autographs.